Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the New Orleans literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with Philip Gould and Herman Fusilier, creators of Ghosts of Good Times, Louisiana Dance Halls Past and Present. We'll also hear from novelist Maria Semple, author of Today Will Be Different, and Nick Maneri, author of The Infinite. Photographer Philip Gould has spent his entire professional life documenting the life, culture, and music of South Louisiana in images and books. Today, we'll be talking with him about his most recent, Ghosts of Good Times, Louisiana Dance Halls Past and Present. We're also talking with Herman Fusilier, entertainment writer of the Daily Advertiser and the Times of Acadiana, who wrote the text for this gorgeous book. We're speaking to them from the studios of KRVS at the University of Louisiana at Lafayette. Philip, Herman, welcome to The Reading Life.
Thank you.
Hello.
Good to be here.
Thank you for having us.
Oh, talk about a labor of love, you two. Congratulations.
Well, thank you. I have to give credit to Herman. We were talking, and he just said, you know, I've always wanted to do a book on all these old places that have closed, but you can still feel the spirit of them. And they were so important back in the day. And the buildings are still with us. And I looked at Herman. That's amazing. And from that, a collaboration was born. And it's been a real treat.
And Herman, a lot of this writing seems really personal to you. You're an Opelousas native who grew up practically within earshot of some of these places.
Yes, that's absolutely right. I mean, I was born and raised in a household filled with music, and one of the clubs featured in our book, Ghost of Good Times, is Bradford's White Eagle, which is still standing but been closed for about 30 years. So my parents were big friends with the owners of this club. And at this club, right in Opelousas, if you can imagine, Sam Cooke, Otis Redding, James Brown, Aretha Franklin, Duke Ellington, just this long list of legendary R&B and blues greats. Some of them were just starting out at the time, but, you know, later became legends and some were already stars. So my sister and I would be at the house next door to Bradford's White Eagle, kind of watching TV, and my parents were in the club partying. So I have memories of kind of hearing the music fade into the house and sort of seeing the lights from the windows. And I wish I could go back now and know who I was listening to. It could have been Fats Domino, could have been Ray Charles, who knows, but just that building in itself played a big role in why I want to do this book.
Oh, it gives me goosebumps when you say those names, I swear. Now, so many of these dance halls were family affairs. They were owned and run by couples or families, then passed on to their descendants, and whole families visited them.
Yeah, they were the community social hub, if you will. I mean, this is where people went when they went out. You know, in these small, isolated communities, that was the place. And people's favorite bands would come. And it was a place where people met, they visited, they danced, courted, everything happened there. Many of the rituals of life occurred in these dance halls across South Louisiana.
And this was, I guess I would say, social media before there was social media, because you went there not only to dance and have a good time, but you exchanged news. You got caught up with relatives and friends. You know, some people, you may have seen them during the week in a work environment, but on the weekends or when these dances went on, you could really socialize and sit back and talk.
So the first part of this book is about dance halls that are no longer in operation. So what was it like for you two to travel to all these defunct dance halls? There's a kind of elegiac, somber quality to those photographs. You know, those are hard-used dance floors and some decrepit buildings that people lived and loved in.
You were looking at a building, you could see the patina of 30, 40 years of nature, humidity, hurricanes, everything else, just wearing down these buildings, but also just providing this layer that made them beautiful in a different way and also gave spirit to what they were in their heyday. And that was always a treat. We went to Bork's Club up in Lewisburg, a town southwest of Opelousas, and it was very surreal. It's like they had walked out the last night, locked the door, and never went back. But they had leaky roofs, and the floors are rotting out, and all the plastic tablecloths that they had originally there the last night were still on the tables. That had not changed, but the building around it was in the process of a long falling apart, you could say.
Well, I love that you've captured some of the signs and the paintings on the walls, and the spirit is there underneath all that.
And what helps, too, I find, with Philip's great photographs, he photographed many of these places in their heyday, like the Blue Moon Saloon and Bork's Club, like you just mentioned. So he has pictures of couples, the guys dressed in shirts and button-up ties, and also the women in their Sunday best, so to speak. And they're seated at the table. Same table he took a picture of them with the red tablecloth is now collapsing into the floor from all the rain and mold and mildew. So just to see that contrast, you can see how lively these places were at one time, and now they're just withering away.
One of the great things about this book, besides Herman's wonderful writing, is that you've called on some other writers as well and musicians to pull together their memories. I love that chapter by former State Poet Laureate Daryl Bourke about the China Ball in Bristol. And you've gotten Barry Onsalay to write about Jay's Lounge and Cockpit in Cambridge.
Because it was a cockpit and a place where hippies listened to Clifton Chenier, sort of a cutting edge, it was a very disparate combination of things. And I needed a professional folklorist who had actually spent many a Saturday night there. This was a tough job to handle, to articulate, and I thought Barry stepped up to the plate very nicely on it. And there were others. Terrence Simeon, Grammy winner twice now, got his start as a teenager at Slim's Waikiki. And that place means so much to him, not only for the community that he grew up in, but also just that he got his start there. His perspective was invaluable. How can you? No one else could tell that story like he could.
Yeah. And
Michael Doucet of Beau Soleil talked about the early days of Mulots as a Cajun restaurant that was, in effect, a dance hall that served food. And, you know, his perspective is also pretty nice to read about.
Yeah, I like Terrence's perspective about Slim's because it's something he grew up with. He mentions in his essay, as a kid, his parents always went to Slim's Waikiki and Opelousas, and they lived out in the country. So just the exotic sounding name of the place, he thought his parents were going to some far off paradise every weekend to party. And then as he became older, he saw what it was all about.
Well, what I love about this book is that you cover every kind of place. You cover places where people go to Cajun dance, Zydeco places, Swamp Bop, Rhythm and Blues,
Honky
a little
tonks.
Bit of everything.
Sure.
Yeah. So if ever a book made you want to go out and dance, this is the one. We've been talking with Philip Gould and Herman Fuselier, photographer and writer, creators of Ghosts of Good Times, Louisiana Dance Halls Past and Present. You can meet them Thursday, November 10th at 6 at Octavia Books. Herman, Philip, thank you so much.
Thank you. It's
great
to talk to you.
Appreciate it.
Maria Semple writes terrific novels about flawed and funny protagonists. Where'd You Go, Bernadette spent more than a year on the bestseller list, and now she's back with Today Will Be Different, a story about an animator named Eleanor Flood, who is having one of the most challenging days imaginable. It's set in Maria's hometown of Seattle, but with some important stops in New Orleans as well. What fun. Maria Semple, welcome to The Reading Life.
Thank you.
I mean, really, who hasn't gotten up in the morning and thought, today will be different? I mean, you set this tone with such hope and determination.
Yes, and to me, the determination is almost what's the most funny about it, is because my protagonist, Eleanor Flood, sets the bar so low for herself in the beginning of the novel. She's not asking to change the world in any great way. She's really trying to be present and shower and not wear yoga pants throughout the entire day, and yet she fails.
Ah, but she does spend some quality time with her son.
She determines to spend quality time with her son and then ends up actually probably spending more quantity time with her son.
Yes.
And maybe not so quality, but yes, indeed, he's along for the ride because she has dropped him off at school and then shortly thereafter received the call that no mother wants to receive, which is that they have to go back to school and pick up their kid.
Well, things do go awry fairly quickly in this novel, and Eleanor has a lot on her mind, doesn't she? Not to mention on her plate as well.
Yes, she does. She is an illustrator, which really is the least of her concerns because she is very much in her own head. She's very disappointed with herself and the way that she conducts herself, and she has compartmentalized a part of her past that today is the day that it's catching up with her.
Now, one of the things I do love about Eleanor is that she has this weekly poetry lesson. And the real life poet in your life when you were writing this book is Ed Skoog, who's known here, of course, for teaching at Tulane and at the New Orleans Center for Creative Arts.
And I love Ed, and I did have a weekly poetry lesson with him where he would assign me poems. I would memorize them and recite them, and then we would discuss the poems. And it was really the high point of every week, and I loved it. And I write really out of my life, you know, and what's going on in my life. If it's something that I love, I just want to toss it in my book, just like I'm a chef, just tossing in something that I love. Just, I don't care if it doesn't even belong in here, I'm putting it in here. And for me, it was my poetry lessons with Ed. And so I start the day, and the day starts to go well with Eleanor at her poetry lesson with her Ed Skoog. I've named him Alonzo Wren. And she gets the call to go pick up Timby at the poetry lesson. But yes, I love Ed, and he's one of my favorite people. And before I wrote the book, I emailed him and I said, I'm writing a book. I think I'm going to have an Ed Skoog character. I'm renaming him Alonzo Wren, and he might suffer some indignities. And I just want to run it by you. And he said, absolutely, I'd be honored.
Of course. I think anyone would be honored. And Alonzo Wren is a wonderful name for a poet, I think.
Thank you. I know. I love that name. Once I came up with a name, it was done.
So that's not the only little echo of New Orleans. That's not the only New Orleans touch in this book by any means. Eleanor's sister, Ivy, finds love with a New Orleans man named Bucky, who's socially very well connected and lives on Coliseum Street. So tell us a bit about your time here, about creating the Crew of Chaos and researching these elaborate Mardi Gras social rituals.
I wanted to find a world where Eleanor, my protagonist, would enter this world and do the wrong things without realizing it. And I wanted it to just build up and have her on her heels and feel like just by being herself, she would offend somebody or she was doing the wrong thing. And it was important for me in the story to find that. I'd already kind of decided theoretically I needed to create another world that had its own rules that were very hard from the outside to understand. And so I was talking to a friend of mine who lives in New York. Her name is Barbara Heller, and she has a lot of family members in New Orleans. And I talked to her a lot about my writing as I'm writing it. And I was saying, oh, I need to come up with this world that has its own rules. And she said, you should do New Orleans. You should do the New Orleans Society. And I had no idea what New Orleans Society was. I have to say, I'd never been to New Orleans. And she sent me some links and sent me some pictures of the debutante balls from the local paper, and I started reading it. And I thought, my gosh, I think this is it. This is so interesting and strange for an outsider. So I booked a plane ticket. And I went to New Orleans. I stayed at a hotel on Bourbon Street because I didn't know that you do not stay at hotels on Bourbon Street. And I landed and I just went outside and took some notes on Bourbon Street. And I was just trying to really see New Orleans through an outsider's eyes. And I knew you could only do that once. And so I was there for about 3 days. I met some really wonderful people, some society people, some artists, you know, just a wonderful array of people. And I just went for it. You know, it was really fun. I'd say I just patched together the things that I'd seen and the places I went and created this world of New Orleans.
Well, it is a lot of fun to read this part because it's very funny. We all recognize so many of these things. And I think people will be delighted or scandalized or, you know, pick your reaction, I think.
Well, you know, what was important for me when I was writing the New Orleans section was that I really liked New Orleans and I liked the people in New Orleans. And Eleanor, my protagonist, Eleanor Flood, really loves New Orleans, and I think she has a really wonderful experience of the people of New Orleans and the society of New Orleans. As you know, she goes in I think, thinking, oh, this is weird and what's going on. But there's a passage in it where she just talks about how charming it is and how all the manners are such a sign of deep respect. And she's realized she's maybe kind of gotten it wrong. And her heart is very open to it. There happens to be one bad egg in New Orleans that she kind of has to do battle with. And so what I'm hoping is that the one bad egg is really the scandalizing character, you know? And I hope that there is loving writing about New Orleans. It's just this one guy who she
right.
gets on the wrong side of that gives her some trouble in her life.
Oh, yes. Bucky Fanning. Yes. Let us name names. Well, there are a lot of women who will read this book and go, yep, I know those moments. We've been talking with the fabulous Maria Semple, whose new book is Today Will Be Different. You can meet her Monday, November 14th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Maria, thank you so much.
Thank you.
It's a great pleasure to welcome Nicholas Maneri to The Reading Life. Nick teaches at Nicholls State University in Thibodaux and lives in New Orleans with his wife and young son. And today we're celebrating the publication of his first novel, The Infinite. So Nick Maneri, welcome to The Reading Life.
Thanks for having me.
Now, this is such an amazing book. We are immediately drawn into the lives of these two young people, Jonah McBee and Luz Hidalgo, who are struggling to make lives for themselves in post-Katrina New Orleans. So tell us a little bit about them.
Well, Jonah is born and raised from New Orleans. He's lost most of his family. He has an older brother who has sort of left him in New Orleans at the family home. His brother lives down at the old family fishing camp. Luz came to New Orleans with her father in the sort of recovery construction boom after Katrina. She's originally from Mexico. She's undocumented. She had been in Texas for a year with her father before they came to New Orleans. And both of them, Jonah and Luz, their lives are sort of defined by loss. And they find each other in New Orleans in high school and sort of find a refuge with each other in their budding romance.
And that kind of young love, it's so powerful and it's such a great subject, isn't it? Didn't you find that part of it kind of swept you along?
Yeah, very much so. Well, for anybody really, that time in our lives, you know, they're 17 and 18 years old. That time in our lives when we're starting to figure out who we are and when we see potential futures with other people, I think that's when really we start to figure out who we are ourselves and who we want to be. And as I was imagining their lives together in New Orleans in sort of these challenging circumstances, I really did feel like that was the thing making the story go.
It reminded me of all those stories we used to hear after Hurricane Katrina about all these kids who had really ended up virtually on their own, you know, and mm-hmm. were trying to get through school, get through the day, have jobs to support themselves mm-hmm. and their family. A lot of kids were out there hanging, in a way, after Katrina.
Some of the more moving things I ever came across after the storm and the flood and stories about the ways that people's lives had changed were stories that young people were telling. You saw them in documentaries, you saw them on the news, you heard them when you talked to people.
So which came first for you, the characters, the setting? How did this novel evolve?
It's an interesting question. The school, that was part of it. The other part of it was the time at which I came to New Orleans. I moved here early 2008 permanently, and a lot of my neighbors were day laborers, people who'd come here for work, and I would spend a few evenings talking with them on the stoop or at the corner bar, that sort of thing. Luz came first, to tell you the truth. I, for whatever reason, was thinking about her, what somebody like her, her experiences would have been like. And everything followed from that.
I love her. She's so fierce. Yeah. I mean, because you're reading along and you are caught up in this wonderful story of two young adults finding each other. And then the book takes a very different turn mm-hmm. and becomes a thriller.
Mm-hmm.
It's set in Mexico, you know, so it's just whoa!
Right, right.
It's that kind of head-turning moment, which is really kind of great. So we have this phenomenal love story, and then we have this chronicle of the Mexican drug wars, because mm-hmm. Luz goes home to her grandmother and inadvertently gets caught up
right.
in all of this. And I wonder if you'd read that passage that describes her so beautifully, because she becomes tougher and tougher over
sure.
time.
Sure, happy to. The driver did not wish to speak with Luz. It was just as well. A bright, hot day, and Luz hadn't slept. She leaned her temple against the window glass and watched the town crawl past. The Honda slowed around a bend, and there, alongside an open-air cafe, was Cicatrice's sign, the red sea with a slash through it. This was the same street, the very same spot, but no evidence suggested the crossfire. The graffito was like a fish skeleton in a cliff face, an insignificant artifact. Luz saw the old woman die, felt the tires leave the blacktop, and she remained calm. The horror of that day no longer seemed like an occurrence that had merely happened to her. To think of it in that way would be to enslave herself to fear and worry. Instead, that day and those following had become something interwoven with her being. I am the woman who crawled from the ditch. I am the woman who escaped in the night. I am the woman who has survived. On her lap, she held a grocery bag tied shut and packed with a change of clothes and a few of her mother's dresses. Her jean leg fit snugly over the silver knife, which she'd strapped to her calf. The hilt started just below her knee, and the point came to just above her ankle. She thought the bulge was only noticeable if one really looked for it. She'd considered leaving the knife behind, but what was the difference? Discarding it wouldn't rid her of the memories associated with it, and should this new path reveal itself to be another circle without escape, she figured she'd better be able to sting.
I love that. I am the woman who escaped in the night. I mean, that's such an amazing thing for such a young girl, that kind of energy and strength to summon up from within at such mm-hmm. a moment. She is fierce. And you give her this fascinating lineage. You give her this great family background and mythology mm-hmm. to draw on. I wonder if you'd talk a little bit about that. That is obviously sure. not you, you know?
Right, of course, yeah. Well, you use the word mythology, and I think that's sort of key. The way that Luz thinks about her family history, she thinks about it in terms of stories that her mother told her when she was growing up. And these are stories that her mother, Luz, learns as she grows older. Her mother had no way of knowing whether or not these things were factually accurate, but they nevertheless come to feel true to Luz. And I think that that is one of the, at least in my mind, one of the themes of the book, you know, where a certain person's truth lies. You know, what you choose to think is the truth of your own self, you know, how you define yourself, where you come from. And this is one of the things that Luz draws strength from.
Now, you know, that kind of spiritual limitlessness is part of what you mean by the title, I'm sure, The Infinite.
I think so.
But there's also so much of the grandeur of nature and the world.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you put those fabulous scenes in the swamp at the fishing camp mm-hmm. when they're out on that dark water and that sense of constant evil lurking below, that sense of Luz in the Mexican wild kind of running toward this pyramid that she may never reach. And then finally you have her father in the Gulf. And all that sense of expansion, you know mm-hmm. what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm glad that you remarked on that. That was something I thought about a lot while working on this book, the expansiveness of the world and sort of the unending or sort of limitless or infinite, if you will, movements of people across its surface, the things that make people move, the things that people are after when they're crossing borders, when they're trying to connect with other people. I was thinking about a lot of that kind of stuff, as well as you mentioned the scenes in the swamp and maybe a certain predatory feel to nature and those sorts of things. I was thinking about those sorts of infinite things as well, the pervading sense of being hounded by something perhaps, or unending strings of bad luck that some of these characters seem to experience. But I was also thinking about things that are infinite in another way, things that are sort of essential, things that maybe we don't notice, things that we can't do without. And one of those things for me are the voices of young people, are the voices of women, are the voices of people who have experienced trauma in some ways. And that too is where the title comes from.
We've been talking with Nick Maneri, whose wonderful new novel is The Infinite. You can meet him Tuesday, November 15th at 6 at Octavia Books, and again Friday, November 18th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Nick, congratulations, and thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. The big event this week is the Pirates Alley Faulkner Society's Words and Music, a literary feast in New Orleans. The Latin American Library at Tulane kicks off events with this year's Big Read, Wednesday, November 9th from 6 to 9:30 at the Freeman Auditorium at Tulane, followed by a reception at the Latin American Library. Editor Jorge Hernandez discusses this year's selection, Sun, Stone, and Shadows, appearing with Tulane professor Yuri Herrera, whose most recent book is Transmigration of Bodies. Latin American Library Director Hortensia Calvo facilitates the discussion. Then Words and Music continues throughout the weekend with great writers Roy Blunt Jr., Brenda Marie Osby, James Borders IV, Kim Vaz DeVille, Carrie and John Gregory Brown, Julia Glass, Nancy Eisenberg, Christina Vella, Roger Kamenetz, and today's guest, Nick Maneri, also appears. National Novel Writing Month founder Chris Beatty, and many more. The Pirates Alley Faulkner Society is 25 years old this year, an important anniversary and a celebration of their many contributions to the literary scene. Also coming up this week, the New Orleans Book Festival takes place. It begins with Music Under the Stars Friday, November 11th from 6:30 to 8 at Ladder Library, and continues Saturday with author appearances from 10 to 2 at Big Lake in City Park. Here are some of the authors who'll be appearing. Best-selling thriller writers Jeff Abbott and Greg Isles, Duck Dynasty's Willie Robertson, children's authors Johnette Downing, and Cowboy Mouth drummer Fred LeBlanc. For more information, go to nolabookfest.org. Stanley Dry signs the Essential Louisiana Seafood Cookbook, Wednesday, November 9th at 6 at Octavia Books. Today's guest, Philip Gould and Herman Fuselier, sign Ghosts of Good Times, Louisiana Dance Halls Past and Present, Thursday, November 10th at 6 at Octavia Books. Yvonne Spear Perret and her son, photographer Paul Perret, sign Simone of New Orleans, Thursday, November 10th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Jeff Weiss facilitates the discussion of Outline by Rachel Cusk. That's at the Maple Street Bookshop Book Group, Thursday, November 10th at 6 at Maple Street Bookshop. Bobby Malone signs Lois Linsky, Storycatcher, Friday, November 11th at 6 at Octavia Books. The Octavia Books Book Club discusses Long Division by Kiese Lehman, Saturday, November 12th at 10:30 at Octavia Books. Lydia Crochet and her dog Jeannie sign Jeannie, the three-legged dog. I don't need 4 feet. Saturday, November 12th at 2 at Octavia Books. Poets Valerie Siang, Laura Glenham, Rodrigo Toscano, Laura Theobald, and Afton Wilkie read their work, Saturday, November 12th at 6 at Maple Street Bookshop. Today's guest, Maria Semple, reads from and signs Today Will Be Different, Monday, November 14th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Danielle A. Van signs The Whizbang Machine, Tuesday, November 15th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Today's guest, Nick Maneri, signs The Infinite, Tuesday, November 15th at 6 at Octavia Books, and appears later that week in discussion with Katie Simpson Smith, Friday, November 18th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, Our Lady of Holy Cross College, and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. Or you can email us anytime at thereadinglife@wwno.org. I'm Susan Larson. Thanks for listening and keep reading.